This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2008 podcast series. Today we're speaking with the authors of The Counselor and the Law, A Guide to Legal and Ethical Practice. This is authored by two individuals. The first individual is Nancy Wheeler. She's licensed to practice law in Maryland and the District of Columbia. She has advised counselors on legal and ethical issues for more than 20 years. She manages the ACA Insurance Trust Risk Management Helpline. Burke Bertram is the other author. He is a licensed mental health counselor and a licensed marriage and family therapist with a practice, with a private practice in Orlando, Florida. Welcome, Nancy and Burt.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Hello there.
Hi.
Good to be here.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, I read your book. I read it last night. I finished it this morning. And I have to tell you, it is a wonderful, valuable book that I could see every working counselor using. I know if I were a working counselor, again, I would want one on my desk.
Well, that's nice to hear, and we support that. Every working counselor in America needs a copy of our book.
They really do. It's practical. It's readable. There isn't really dense legal language that might be kind of difficult for some of us working counselors. So it's just fabulous. But now I'm going to get to some questions about the book. And the first question that comes to mind is, why did you write this book at this time?
Well, let me take an opening thought about that.
Okay.
The book, The Counselor and the Law, was actually originally written in 1975 and published. And since then, it's been updated three times, and each time with different authors. The fourth edition was released in 1996. So obviously the field has evolved a great deal since 1996, including the new 2005 ACA Code of Ethics.
Right.
So the book was pretty far outdated, and when Carolyn Baker, the Director of Publications for ACA, approached us and asked us if we'd be interested in rewriting the book, we really jumped at the chance because it was really an opportunity to completely update and significantly expand the book to really reflect what's going on now. Because, and Nancy, I think you'd probably like to add that the legal landscape has changed a great deal in recent years.
Well, that's very true, Bert. One example would be HIPAA. Everybody's heard about HIPAA, and it's not that large animal, even though some may think it is. But when the last edition of this book came out, the statute was just being passed in that very year, and the regulations hadn't come out yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a lot of confusion among counselors as to whether they're even covered under HIPAA.
Right.
Many of them are, but a number of them are not. It depends on the practice setting. So we did take great pains in the book to try to help people figure out, am I covered under HIPAA? What are tools to help me with this? The other thing, the advent of the Internet. I mean, the widespread use of the Internet since the mid-1990s when this was last written. We tried, when possible, to give people links to websites that would give them an idea of, well, what does the law actually say on a particular issue?
It seems like with HIPAA, Nancy, please correct me if I'm wrong, that there is some question about the term psychotherapy notes.
That's true.
Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, when HIPAA was being written, when the regulations were being written,
mm-hmm.
the mental health groups, this is an area where they really kind of banded together and said, we need protection for clients and patients in the area of confidentiality and privacy. And the upshot of everybody putting their heads together was that psychotherapy notes are carved out. You need a specific written authorization in order to release psychotherapy notes under HIPAA.
Mm-hmm.
They're also defined as, I'm going to give you just a nutshell version of this, the contents of the conversation between therapist and client. They would not include things that would go in another official record like counseling start and stop times, diagnosis, prognosis, and things of that nature. So it's some of the more sensitive stuff that goes in those psychotherapy notes, so HIPAA gives added protection to those. There are also some state laws that have, in light of HIPAA, kind of enacted that. HIPAA doesn't totally wipe out all the state laws on confidentiality and privacy, but it provides sort of a floor level of privacy.
Mm-hmm. Now, Bert, do you feel as though you are covered under HIPAA, or?
Well, as a, I am a private practitioner, but I do not, I am not a covered entity based upon the way in which I've organized my practice, because I do not.
You don't do anything electronically, do you?
That's right. I do not.
Healthcare claims or that type of thing?
Direct. I do not even do insurance claims, so I am completely a fee-for-service counselor and then counselor educator and consultant. So although I think we all recognize that even though I'm not a covered entity and others are not covered entities, it doesn't mean that some of the thought behind and the regulations behind HIPAA won't be leaching, if you will, into the standard of care that we're going to begin to will be expected of all of us. So we want to be mindful of that, even if you're not a covered entity, that the issues of privacy, confidentiality, and privilege exist for everyone, whether you're a covered entity or not.
Exactly.
So, let me just kind of return just for a moment to the question that you ask about our motivation to write the book, because it's something else we want to say about that, and that is that, you know, in the introduction that you gave, you talked about Nancy's experience working the helpline and my clinical experience and also teaching ethics and other kinds of things. But also, for about 15 years, Nancy and I did a seminar around the country called The Legal Aspects of Counseling. And we really came to understand through that seminar that counselors wanted more than just a list of do's and don'ts. That didn't make sense. They wanted to understand how legal and ethical practice supports quality counseling. And so a lot of our motivation for this book is really aspirational ethics. We want to really make sure that practicing counselors get it. They get how good clinical work is supported by ethical practice and being mindful of the legal issues, because we know that some counselors do get in trouble. While the frequency of counselors being sued is very small, we do know is the frequency of counselors being reprimanded or at least having a complaint filed against them by their state counseling board is growing, and you're actually more vulnerable in that arena than you are to a lawsuit. And
interesting.
Yeah, because it doesn't take as much to the standard of what is required to file a complaint against a counselor is much lower than what must be met in order to successfully have a lawsuit.
Well, the other thing to add to that, Bert, is some people will use the licensure board complaint as a springboard to a malpractice suit.
Right.
So they'll see what happens there and then may not file a civil suit afterwards. So we really have seen a big increase in the number of state licensure board complaints in recent years.
And, you know, we tend to think about counselors that have a complaint or against them from the licensing board or certainly a lawsuit, and immediately we begin to thinking about, gosh, they must have really done something wrong. And while it's true that some counselors have done something wrong, and sometimes that the thing they did wrong was quite wrong and quite thoughtless, maybe even malicious. But that's really, really the exception. Far more often what happens is the counselor, even a good counselor, is in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Right.
And something bad happens, something they couldn't have foreseen, they couldn't have controlled, but yet the client commits suicide or attempts suicide, harms themselves or somebody else, or threatens that, or some other harm is done to the client, and the counselor is in the way of that harm and is drawn into that. And so a lot of the motivation for writing this book was to arm counselors with a deeper understanding of how they can manage their practice in a way that reduces the likelihood that that will occur. And if it does occur, then they're in a position to see it coming, take mm-hmm. steps to minimize the risk, and if all goes wrong, then at least they're in a better position to be defended because they have done the things that they need to do in order to be more easily defended.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting when you're talking about, when you mentioned harm, it made me think of the Tarasoff decision. And I was very interested reading in the book about how things have changed since the Tarasoff decision. Can you say a few words about that, Nancy?
Sure. Tarasoff, as you may know, came through the court system in California in the mid to late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
After Tarasoff, this issue was entertained in a number of different states around the country. One of the things that happened that I think really kind of influenced where this issue went in terms of duty to warn and protect when you had mm-hmm. a client who was posing a risk of violence against a third party.
Mm-hmm.
One of the directions this took was mental health professionals became very concerned about their potential liability, because up to this point, the counselor, client, or whatever the mental health therapist, patient relationship was pretty much sacrosanct.
Right.
And this was considered privileged, and this was a huge change to think that there could be liability for what your client does to a third party. A number of state legislatures enacted statutes immunizing counselors and other mental health therapists from liability. So
mm-hmm.
in essence, if they took certain steps, for example, notifying the potential victim, calling the police, that type of thing, then
mm-hmm.
They would be immune from civil liability, which means, well, somebody could file a suit against them, but they wouldn't be found
mm-hmm.
liable
mm-hmm.
in a malpractice suit. As a result of that kind of action, a number of states passed these types of statutes, and some of them were broadened. For example, in the state of Maryland, where I'm from, the statute takes the form of a counselor can make a decision to warn the potential victim, notify the police, or can actually take steps based on the counselor's clinical judgment that are clinically calculated to eliminate the possibility of the threat.
Mm-hmm.
That's very broad. It's
yeah.
a broad response, but I think the legislature went along with the mental health professional in that case and decided, well, you know, this really makes sense, and we don't want to hold counselors, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, et cetera. We don't want to hold them liable if they take reasonable steps when
mm-hmm.
they're facing an issue like this. And one size doesn't necessarily fit all. There
mm-hmm.
may be times when
mm-hmm.
making a warning could actually exacerbate the risk of violence.
Mm-hmm.
For
yeah.
example, if you've got a situation involving domestic violence.
Yes.
If you go ahead and you make a warning because you're a counselor and a woman has come into you and says, I just can't take it anymore, I'm going to kill that SOB husband of mine, and you go ahead and you make a warning in that case, that could actually trigger violence against your client. So sometimes these things need to be thought out very, very carefully. And the types of laws that are created in response to this should take into effect the fact that counselors and other mental health professionals need to make good judgments.
That's one of the things I love about this book, is it makes the working counselor stop and think about these issues. Very, very important. Which really leads me to my next question, which is in... You know, in counseling, we often talk about the tension between the opposites. A question I have for you is, how do we balance the tension between privacy issues and the safety of others?
You know, that is really one of the prime issues of the last few years. I think all of us can recognize that based on Columbine, Virginia Tech, the school tragedies right now. It is
yes.
extremely important that we as a society come to some kind of balance between the issues of confidentiality, privilege, and privacy on the one hand, and, you know, the potential issues that arise regarding safety of the public. And I think in doing that, one of the things that we did do in the book, we tried to come up with some practical risk management suggestions when a counselor is faced with a situation, either, you know, a school counselor in a Virginia Tech-type situation or a counselor in private practice who has someone who is threatening to harm someone. And, you know, a few of these suggestions, we start with the fact how important it is the counselors let their clients know the limits of confidentiality at the very outset of counseling and
yes.
give periodic reminders. Some of the other suggestions we give in that section of the book are it's very important to consult with colleagues. Two heads are always better than one.
And, you know, if I just may add,
mm-hmm.
this is, we talk about consult like, almost like, well, you know, of course, but how many times, and I think practicing counselors, and I love your term, Rebecca, working counselors.
Yes.
Working counselors, especially if they've been around a while, they sort of get a mindset about how things ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important, after you're a working counselor and you're beyond the need for regular supervision and you think you know what's going on, you can get calcified, and the whole idea of consult, 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 especially around those issues in which there is a potential danger for harm to a client or someone else, is so important because other people will see it different. They will raise questions and issues that you didn't think about, and as a result, your clinical decision-making will be far better than if you're trying to go it alone.
Very good point. Do you have anything else to add to that, Nancy? Or?
Well, I mean, in the book we have just a really rather large list of things. To add to that, we suggest the counselors consider when is it appropriate to make referrals.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes counselors try to do everything themselves. I've seen that before.
Yes.
They might not have even considered referring someone for an evaluation for medication management. If you've got somebody who's potentially suicidal, for example,
mm-hmm.
And you don't even consider that with mm-hmm. a depressed patient, you may not be meeting the standard of care.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing in this regard, I always recommend to the people that I speak with when this kind of issue comes up to make sure that they try to find out and obtain prior history.
Mm-hmm.
We can't always, and counselors cannot, take this crystal ball and decide, well, this one's going to act out in this way and this one's going to act out in that way. But one of the things that we have seen and studies have shown that if there is a prior history of violence, there is a much greater risk that the person is going to act out and do something. Same
mm-hmm.
thing with suicide. If there is a prior suicide attempt, it's more likely somebody will actually carry that through the next time. So.
Yes.
Those are some of the things we want counselors to be aware of, in addition to inquiring about access to weapons and plans when the situation
mm-hmm.
is appropriate to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, considering all appropriate responses and knowing what the law says in your state. So
mm-hmm.
if you're in a state like California where you may, in a terror assault type situation, have to notify the police, warn the victim, do something along those lines, as opposed to being in Maryland where it may call for a broader response, that's something counselors need to know. They
mm-hmm.
need to know what the law says, and they also need to know what the institutional policy says if they're working in an agency. Because from a legal standpoint, if you don't follow the policy
mm-hmm.
that's set for your institution, boy, you're feeding a lot to a plaintiff's lawyer
mm-hmm.
in that case. And the other big thing in this regard is we really suggest that people document carefully what they considered, what they rejected, why, what was the ultimate decision.
Yes, yes. And I realize we've talked about the Tarasoff decision a couple of times now, and there might be somebody listening who doesn't really know what it is. Could you give us a brief description of what that decision is?
Sure, sure. This was a case that originated in California. There was a young man who was being treated at the University of California at Berkeley in the counseling center there. His therapist became concerned that this young man was going to kill his, we'll call it an ex-girlfriend. I think he actually had very little actual dating experience with this young woman, but she went off to South America for the summer. The therapist got campus police engaged, and the upshot of this was they found there was really no grounds to hold him. And when she returned to the university after the summer, the young man actually did kill this young woman whose name was Tarasoff. Well,
yes.
You can imagine that Tarasoff's parents were quite upset, so they sued the university, the psychologist, psychiatrist, everybody that was really connected with this. And the theory that they used, that there was a duty to warn Tarasoff. And following the Tarasoff decision, it really came out that the court basically said that once a therapist determines they're under applicable professional standards, should have determined that a patient poses a risk of violence to a third party. That therapist has a duty to take certain steps.
And it went to the Supreme Court, is that correct,
Nancy? It went to the
Nancy?
Supreme Court of the state of California.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it was one of those things that went up and down. Now, I'm glad you asked that question because Tarasoff does not apply in every state in the United
mm-hmm.
States. Most of the states have followed some type of a Tarasoff rule, but not all of them have specifically adopted Tarasoff. Some have actually gone farther and gone beyond the Tarasoff duty, which is there's a duty to warn and or protect if you have a specific identifiable victim. Some of them have kind of fashioned a broader rule that if somebody is within a foreseeable zone of danger, there's a duty to act, which is a very broad standard.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's states like Texas, which have not adopted Tarasoff, but they still have a law that governs confidentiality that will permit a counselor to make a warning in a particular circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
If there really is an imminent risk of harm to somebody,
mm-hmm.
And that's true in most states. Even if they haven't adopted Tarasoff, usually there is something in a state licensure board confidentiality law or something that would permit a counselor or other mental health therapist to take some action to protect human life.
Bert, I want to ask you, as we're talking about the Tarasoff decision, did it change your clinical practice when this decision came about?
Well, this decision was really very early in my clinical practice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the perspective we might want to gain is that the law is living,
mm-hmm.
and it evolves based upon experiences and events and the meaning that we attach to those. And so even though we're talking a great deal about Tarasoff, since it was sort of the defining case, but I think what we're seeing now as a result of Virginia Tech and other school shooting tragedies is that there's a great deal of rethinking going on about this tension around safety and privacy.
Yes.
And the way in which we've thought about confidentiality and the exceptions under which we would violate confidentiality have been taught to us, and now we're going to be, I think, invited to rethink those based upon the kind of client we're working with, the settings that we're in, and that counselors should be very mindful that this is a fluid issue that is being talked about in every state, in every university, every school, not to mention professional associations. And so whatever it is that, however they were originally trained, they want to remain current and alert to the fact that this is a moving target.
Yes.
And
yes.
We're going to be seeing new points of view emerge over the next several years that may well be the new Tarasoff and change the way in which we think about this.
That brings me to another question. When you're talking about the state law, and one of the real good take-home messages I got from reading your book was how important it is to really read your state law, keep up on it, and understand it. And that brings me to another question, which is, what do we need to know about state licensing boards?
The answer to that is you need to know a lot.
A lot.
These entities have enormous influence over the practice of counseling for the in-the-field working counselor.
Mm-hmm.
As we know, counselors are now licensed in 49 states and in the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico. Only California remains as the holdout for professional counselors.
And I'm a California girl, so watch out.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
But state by state, these laws came into being over the last 32 years, and every state has put its own unique twist and perspective based upon the personality of the state, the political agenda that was in place, the compromises, all the things that led to the creation of statutes. So we look across the country and we see different kinds of laws that call things different things, that that therefore, just because somebody has a general understanding of what licensing means, they need a very specific understanding of what it means in their state.
Yeah.
And licensing boards have enormous power to define practice and to hold people accountable to the standard that they believe is appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And no two states do it exactly the same way. Requirements for licensing, supervision, renewals, CEUs, violations, they all differ.
And the procedures often differ,
that's
too,
right.
If there's an investigation. I was on the phone with somebody the other day, and this person had a licensure board complaint brought against him in a state where they would not tell the counselor as an initial matter who actually filed the complaint. That is true in some states.
But they still wanted the counselor to respond.
You have to give some information, or they want to meet with you, they want to ask questions, but it's a little hard to respond if that's the process there. I'm always a lot more comfortable if it's a situation where the person knows exactly who complained up front. Not that you can't treat that with a certain amount of discretion, but these procedures really do vary, and sometimes the board has no, this is something by statute that was created a certain process, and then the boards will implement those statutes by creating their own rules, but different states have their own ways of handling the whole due process rights of a counselor who's subject to an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And the authority as well as the composition of boards, it differs state by state.
Yes.
There's some boards that have consumer members who are not counselors, as well as counselors, and as a result, they may have perspectives about the field that that aren't necessarily shared by the professional community.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that can influence the way in which decisions are made and the consequences of those decisions for practicing counselors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, another thing is I'm often asked, well, do I really need to have an attorney with this licensure board proceeding? Increasingly, I think almost always the answer is yes, because otherwise I think counselors can say things and dig themselves in deeper, and they may not really know what their rights are.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely advise people to have local counsel involved when there's a licensure board complaint. And along with that, I think it's important when you're looking for a professional liability insurance policy to choose one that may provide some defense costs to you, reimbursement of those defense costs if you're involved in a licensure board proceeding. Because as Bert said before, these are more numerous now than the actual civil complaints against counselors.
Yes, and I just want to add briefly, I also think that when we seek an attorney who knows something about counselors and about the profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Very important.
It is. You don't want to just hire your brother or sister-in-law that does wills and estates.
Exactly. What
okay.
were you going to say, Bert? I'm sorry.
That's quite all right.
Mm-hmm.
I was simply going to make the point that I don't remember.
That's okay.
Okay, I make a mistake.
We're all allowed to have a senior moment. I know,
yeah,
I have.
Even those of us that are junior, huh?
Even when we're junior. Very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things when I was reading your book that I thought about is that once again the dual relationships come up. And as somebody who's worked in a number of agencies, this has just come up again and again and again. But something I found very interesting in your book was your discussion regarding transference and countertransference. It's very good to kind of rethink those issues when you're wondering about why are these dual relationships still coming up. Can you comment on that, Bert?
The whole notion of transference and countertransference, it's these wonderful professional terms, but when it comes right down to it, it means that we're human beings. It means that sometimes we over-identify with our clients, sometimes clients project things onto us that aren't true, and the human interaction, which is never more human and never more intimate in the non-sexual sense than in the counseling environment, has the potential of generating its own kind of distortion.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, counselors sometimes do things that if they could have stepped back and stepped away from the power of that countertransference, that the power of that over-identification or over-concern, they wouldn't have done. But it tapped into something in their humanity that cause them to engage in distorted behavior. And therefore, we really have to be mindful of the fact that the dual relationships, co-occurring relationships, are the background for so many state licensing board complaints. Because it's a slippery slope. You start it, and you're not trying to do the wrong thing, but you just, one thing leads to another, and eventually you end up violating the client's confidentiality, doing something that offends and upsets the client, and as a result, while it's not grounds for a lawsuit, it is certainly grounds for a complaint. And out of that can come all kinds of things. You can have sanctions against your license. You can have your license suspended, or you certainly are going to incur costs associated with the fines, not to mention just the professional embarrassment of having a complaint and then having your name published as you having been disciplined.
Well, Bert, it also, from a time perspective, these things go on and on and on,
because
when you apply for, let's say you're applying for a job somewhere, or you're applying to be on managed care panel, you've got to be honest about, well, has there been any disciplinary action brought against
me,
that type of thing. So this just goes on and on and on.
Well, not only does it live forever, but the complaint process itself can drag on for many months, and it generates enormous anxiety and fear about your future employability.
Yeah, it's a very slippery slope, and you talked about in your book several times consulting with your coworkers, discussing things with your supervisors, that kind of thing. And I think one of the things that should be on the table often as counselors meet and talk and perhaps case staff clients is transference and countertransference. You know, let's talk about it.
And let's not talk about it like you've done something wrong. Let's acknowledge it's part of the human condition and that we all have clients that tap into something in us that is leading to a distortion. It's not something to be ashamed of or embarrassed about.
Excellent.
But it is something to talk about so that we can help take away the energy that the transference or countertransference has so we can act in the best interest of the client and, frankly, in our own best interest.
Exactly. Exactly. Is there anything else we need to know about state licensing boards?
Well, I think that just a couple more points.
Okay.
And that is that it's really the average working counselor's responsibility to stay current about what's going on with the licensing board, to speak up and to advocate. Licensing boards have the power to develop rules and policies, and they generally come in a proposed form. We need to be aware of what they are to make sure that the rule or the policy is not onerous or that it's not at odds with the standard of care. And if we think it is, we have a responsibility to communicate in a respectful but forceful way our point of view. And if we don't engage in that dialogue, then we're just accepting whatever the licensing board dishes up, but we're going to be responsible for it.
And get local legal counsel and legal counsel that knows about the profession of counseling.
If a complaint is brought against you, immediately you want to contact your liability carrier,
mm-hmm.
assuming that you have liability insurance, which you should, and assuming that it provides coverage for license complaints, and work with the carrier to identify the appropriate legal counsel so that you get the right person to represent your interest.
Mm-hmm. Bert, I might add to that, too, for counselors who are insured through the ACA Insurance Trust, through their mm-hmm. sponsored program, in that case, there are defense costs that are offered as part of that, and they also are able to call the risk management helpline if
mm-hmm.
they have questions and issues about that.
Which is a wonderful perk that comes with that insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Was there also a CEU package that's being offered regarding your book?
There is. Nancy, tell us all about it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, there is, actually. Bert and I got together with ACA and developed a test that would flow. If a counselor purchases and reads The Counselor and the Law and
mm-hmm.
then takes a test that is available online
mm-hmm.
Through the ACA, and if they pass that test, they are immediately awarded a certificate. And not only do they get the CEUs, if they have insurance through the ACA-sponsored program, then they can also get a 10% discount off their professional liability insurance for 3 consecutive years. So that helps pay for the cost.
That is excellent.
Yeah.
That is excellent. And since I really believe, I'm not just saying this, I really believe that this book needs to be on every working counselor's desk. It either has the answers or it points you in the direction where you can find the answers. It's really an absolutely wonderful, pragmatic, well-written book. And I want to thank you both for being here today. Is there anything either of you want to add?
The other thing that I might add to that, too, I appreciate
mm-hmm.
your kind words, Rebecca, but we also had in mind when we wrote this book, we had students in mind because
good point.
Students as well as new practitioners, seasoned practitioners, it really runs the gamut. I think there are a lot of people who wish they had access to something like that when they were students. And a time when you're really forming your ideas in terms of how you practice, at a time when you should be developing an ethical decision-making model for yourself, this is a time to be reading something like this when you're a student.
That is an absolutely wonderful idea. And, yes, students should be reading this, and I hope supervisors are aware of it and are making sure that students are reading this. Anything else that you wanted to add, Bert?
I would conclude by saying that if there's one piece of advice I could offer up, it's that every counselor have a file, a 3-ring notebook, something that is their risk management file that has a copy of the counseling licensing statute, the rules, other important statutes like child abuse reporting and elder reporting,
mm-hmm.
as well as the ethical code, all the things that, and perhaps some checklists regarding assessing for lethality or suicidality.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not something that you necessarily need every day, but when you need it, you want to know where to lay your hands on it.
Mm-hmm.
There are counselors who I affectionately refer to as they're operating a 2.0 level of practice in a 6.0 world. They've missed some updates.
Yeah.
And I encourage people to begin to put together this folder so that they can be legally and ethically a 6.0 counselor.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent idea. And, you know, if nothing else, this notebook can be a kind of tickler to remind you about things.
You bet.
And to
take
read
a course.
The,
read a book.
Read the book.
There you go.
And a tickler to remind you of things, but also a place where you can read the law again. Even if you have a very short reporting law in your jurisdiction, wherever you are, it really behooves you to just kind of read it over and over again and make sure you understand what you are and aren't supposed to report, et cetera.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Nancy Wheeler and Bert Bertram, for joining me today to discuss your excellent book, The Counselor and the Law, A Guide to Legal and Ethical Practice. Please go to the American Counseling Association's website at www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page to purchase The Counselor and the Law, to view the associated links, and to write to the authors and the host. Thank you very much for joining us today. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host of the ACA 2008 podcast series, signing off.